Hello, this is Pennsylvania State Senator Gene Yaw of the 23rd Senate District. I'm calling you live from the State Capitol building to discuss a very important subject, heroin and opioid addiction. We are holding this telephone town hall because we want to hear your thoughts and answer your questions regarding this epidemic. To ask a question at any time during this call, please press star 3 on your phone. Heroin and opioid addiction is something that has touched each and every one of us, whether personally, professionally, or from an economic perspective. This is the fourth in a series of legislative telephone town halls, which has allowed us to bring the issue of heroin and opioid addiction to the forefront. Again, to ask a question at any time during this call, press star 3 on your phone. With me in the studio tonight are a panel of experts to discuss heroin and opioid addiction. We want to offer you the opportunity to speak directly with them about this growing epidemic. As I said, tonight's telephone town hall is unique in that it will focus on one key subject area, heroin and opioid addiction in the South Central region of Pennsylvania. Tonight's telephone town hall is being sponsored by your area state senators that include Senator Rich Alloway, Senator Ryan Aumont, Senator John DeSanto, Senator Mike Fulmer, Senator Scott Martin, Senator Mike Regan, Senator Scott Wagner. This town hall allows you to listen in, offer your opinions, and ask questions from your home. Reports have indicated that approximately 80% of heroin addicts trace their addiction back to prescription opioids. Today, approximately 10 people will die in Pennsylvania from a drug overdose. We lose 1,000 people a week in the United States from drug overdoses. Since 2014, the Center for Rural Pennsylvania, a legislative research agency of the General Assembly, of which I serve as chairman, has conducted 12 public hearings on the heroin and opioid epidemic, which has now taken center stage on the local, state, and national levels. And tonight, we would like to hear your thoughts and opinions on this issue. Before we meet our panel of experts, I'd again like to thank our area senators for sponsoring this telephone town hall event and who represent you across South Central Pennsylvania. Senator Rich Alloway, Senator Ryan Aumont, Senator John DeSanto, Senator Mike Fulmer, Senator Scott Martin, Senator Mike Regan, and Senator Scott Wagner. With me here in the studio to discuss the subject of heroin and opioid addiction are our special guests for tonight, York County Coroner Pam Gay, Detective Sergeant John Burke of the Lancaster County Drug Task Force, and Barry Dank, Director of the Center for Rural Pennsylvania. As we begin this evening, again, I would like to remind you that if you would like to ask a question at any time during the phone conversation, please press star 3 on your phone. You can also stream the conversation online by visiting www.acommonwealthcrisis.com. That's www.acommonwealthcrisis.com. At this point, I'd like to welcome our panelists. As we said, it's Pam Gay, the coroner of York County, Detective Sergeant John Burkhart of Lancaster County Drug Task Force, and Barry Dank, the director of the Center for Rural Pennsylvania. I guess the first question we'll have, and I'd throw this out to everybody to talk about it, is how can I tell that someone is addicted to heroin?
Well, I'll start. This is Pam Gay. I will start by saying that many times they can hide it for a while, and they can be functioning, and they can be working, contributing to society. So it can be kind of confusing for families. But some of the things that we hear, and we obviously hear after many of them have died, but we hear the families tell us all the time, the pinpoint pupils, that's a classic sign. The flu-like symptoms, because many of them go through many cycles of withdrawal. And we hear all the time families telling us, well, I thought they just had the flu, or they call in sick for a couple days at work, and until they get their next fix or they get some sort of pill, opioid to hold them over till they get their heroin, they do go through withdrawal on a regular basis. Sometimes they obviously are stealing from their loved ones. You notice your bank account goes low all of a sudden. Valuables are missing around your home. this is a disease where, unfortunately, there's a lot of mistrust, and families don't realize that at first, but it does create mistrust because they lie to their families and loved ones. It's sometimes hard to figure out the symptoms. Obviously, if they have track marks, if they have paraphernalia, which I'm sure you can talk about, I'll defer to you for that one. So.
Yes. This is John Burkhardt. I'm a detective in Lancaster County with the Drug Task Force. As Ms. Gay said, one thing you will notice if somebody is using heroin, you will notice the pinpoint pupils, labored breathing a lot of times, very drowsy-looking eyes. We call it like a nod-off. I've seen several people look like they're actually falling asleep while I talk to them when they're using heroin. You also notice some weight loss, lack of responsibility in hygiene, lack of hygiene, and also you'll notice people start they'll stay out away from you for a while because they don't want you to see, you know, the things they're doing with their addiction. You'll notice you know, they might start stealing, getting in trouble with the law to support their habit. All things you that you should look for with a heroin addict.
This is Barry Dank. If I may, finally, just a couple things. Start association with a new crowd of friends, people that they long associated with. They'll, in effect, divorce themselves from that crowd. Even their dress may become much more somber, more subdued, black clothing, that type of thing. For our young folks in school, obviously a decline in grades, a decline in attendance. Even their room, they get to learn how to hide things in their rooms so that parents can't find items from them.
I will also say they hide things in their cars. A lot of them don't like to use in their home, and they'll hide things in their cars.
We have Kathy on the line from Lancaster County. Kathy, what's your question?
My question, I already told the person on the line my question. I was concerned about doctors being educated because I think doctors are giving out too much medicine. I've seen opiate addicts, people that have already been addicted or maybe in recovery, and they go to a doctor for something, and the doctor immediately gives them medicine, just like I believe, I'm sorry, that they're giving too much medicine to older people. But I think that doctors need to be trained. And I know I was just told there were two bills that were passed, but I think doctors need a lot of training. They need to understand addiction better. They need to be able to see it. They need to look for it. They need to take the history of these people who are going, and they give them medicine over and over and over, and I'm glad they passed those bills. But that is my biggest concern.
All right. Thank you for your question. I'll answer that because the bills you're talking about were actually ones that I sponsored. And you're right. We did not have anything in Pennsylvania that required pain management training or any kind of training, medical education for doctors. Actually, we were told in the series of hearings that we had that veterinarians receive more training on pain management than medical doctors. So we hope that we've remedied that, or at least we've started to address it. And, you know, we're working on it. This problem was not created overnight. It's not going to be solved overnight. So we're, but we are aware of it, and the legislature is working on the problem. We have Mary on the line from Franklin County. What's your question, Mary?
How many times is a first responder going to bail out a drug addict? We see them all the time. They give them this medication to keep to save their life from an overdose of heroin or something. How many times does a person get that chance? I've seen in the newspaper where they've had people they've given the medication to. It's brought them out of their near-death situation, and maybe a month, 6 months, or 6 weeks later, they're doing the same thing, and the first responders are obligated to give them this medication. I mean, it's like these people know that they're going to survive, so they can do anything.
All right. Thank you for your question. I'm going to ask the coroner to address that.
Well, thank you. Yes, I would say I often get that question, and I respond usually this way, because a lot of people don't understand that this is a disease. You have to understand it's a disease. And, you know, until you accept that it's a disease, it's really hard to understand this concept. But just as in a chronic smoker or somebody with heart disease who continues to do things that they know are not good for their body, they will continue to do them, and we will continue to say them over and over again. I'm a nurse. I've been trained to save life as much as I can and to do no harm. And so part of that training is we say them over and over again, however long it takes. This is a disease process. Their mind is not thinking clearly. They don't really understand the concept that they just about died, most of them. And so it may take many, many times for some. It may take more than once. Some it may take multiple times before you finally get to the point where hopefully you get them to think about going into treatment. This is a disease. It doesn't happen overnight. But we do believe that without naloxone that you're talking about here, that life-saving drug, that many more would have died. And we would have had literally hundreds more deaths in York County alone, as well as these other counties, were it not for that Narcan. So you have to understand the disease. And just as we continue to save the chronic smoker by putting them on a ventilator and ambuing them with an ambu bag when they can't breathe, or somebody with heart disease, we're always there with the defibrillator, the AEDs that are in many businesses now even. So we will continue to do that. And it's important to understand that, that this is not something that somebody can just decide to stop doing. It's a disease.
We've heard that before, too, that this center, yeah, that the person who has a heart attack and then continues to go to McDonald's or eat to have an improper diet, we don't say, well, you didn't follow your doctor's orders, you didn't get any exercise, so this time we're not going to save you. That's the bottom line. It's not the first responder's choice in this matter, I don't think.
Yeah, I'm in law enforcement, and my answer to that question would also be every time. We're saving lives, and we understand it's a disease also. I get reports of overdoses every day, and whether naloxone was used, and typically it is now. Every department in Lancaster County except one carries naloxone. Everybody agrees that it's an important thing. We are saving lives. We are seeing the same people being saved over and over again. I agree with that. And I believe, and I know the district attorney of Lancaster County believes, that there's got to be a back end to this where we start getting people into treatment as part of the naloxone program.
And I'd like just to follow up with Sergeant Burkhardt said, I agree, and we have heard this in the hearings that we've had, that if you save someone, you need to follow up treatment. And that's something that we haven't figured out an answer to that yet, or what's going to happen, how to do that. It's called the warm handoff, and so that somebody just isn't saved and they have no place to go after that. But that's something that we're working on. We have Lorraine on the phone from Lancaster. Lorraine, what's your question?
My question is, how do they know where to go to get this stuff from these people? And if the police know who they are, why aren't they picked up?
Okay, good question. We'll ask Sergeant Burkhardt to address that.
Well, how they know where to go is through the grapevine. You know, a lot of addicts hang out with other addicts. They know where to go in their community to get heroin. We try to pick up as many as we can. We had 84 investigations last year, which was 69% of our felony drug investigations in 2016 were involved heroin sales. We arrested 79 people through those investigations. We know there's many more. Those investigations do take time. What I would also say is, we need citizens to call in and tell us that this activity is going on. I mean, we know about a lot of it, but it's not just in one area any longer. I know in Lancaster County, it used to be a Lancaster City problem. It's no longer just a Lancaster City problem. It is in every municipality in Lancaster. So we need the citizens to help us. And so if you know anything like that or know somebody that's selling drugs, please call in and let us know.
This is Barry Dank. Just to add to that, for a number of dealers, this is strictly a business for them. There are those who sell drugs to support their habit, but there are those who are in this strictly as a business, and they run it in a very sophisticated way, and they use cell phones. So they may sell drugs on one street corner and move a couple blocks away or miles away for another drop. And especially when you're out in rural areas and they may not have local police force in unpopulated areas, sometimes it's a real challenge to identify these dealers and to get them in the act. We need to understand that this is a sophisticated business of selling drugs, and it's a challenge to deal with that.
We have a question that came in online. When will there be prosecution to those who add fentanyl to the heroin and that people are taking, causing an immediate death in many cases? I don't know. Who wants to answer that question?
Well, I can speak to that a little bit. There is no separate prosecution for a fentanyl and heroin mix. There is a statute now where people can be charged with a delivery of a controlled substance resulting in death. That's the angle we have to take now. That's what is in the law. At some point, maybe the legislation will be enacted to attempt to identify fentanyl and heroin mix as a separate crime.
And I will say in York County, we are using that charge successfully, drug delivery resulting in death, and actually we do autopsies on every heroin-related death, as do most of the counties now, I think, just because it does help with that charge and makes it somewhat less, it removes some of the hurdles. So.
It's a very good question. Most of the heroin we are seeing now that resulted in overdose or a fatal overdose has been mixed with fentanyl, and we are also getting some lab reports back where the controlled substance we thought was just heroin actually contained fentanyl or was pure fentanyl.
And we are seeing designer fentanyl in York County. I would imagine you are too, probably.
Yes we are.
Yeah.
We have Wayne on the line from Franklin County. Wayne, what's your comment?
My comment is that I have been fighting this for a good many years. And had people in my home under a home care plan. And it seems like the corrections people, once they get a hold of it, is more interested in the money for rehab, more interested in correction than what they are handling this disease. And I want to know what can be done through our legislation to try to make it more disease.
Thank you for your question. What can be done, I think, is educate people as to the fact that this is a disease and it's not some kind of a psychological shortcoming because somebody becomes addicted. And I'll open this up to any of the other panel members want to comment on that.
This is Barry Dank. I think we've seen a major turnaround with the corrections departments around the state at the county level and at the state level recognizing that this is a disease. And from a cost standpoint, it really is a cost savings to get people in treatment and to help them deal with their addiction. But I know at the state prisons, they have a Vivitrol program in place for those who are suffering from a substance abuse disorder to help them deal with that and to no longer be dependent on drugs. So I think the corrections industry is now a very viable partner in the treatment side of trying to deal with this disease, and they've come a long way.
You have a comment on this?
Yeah, this is Detective Burkhart. I just wanted to make it clear that law enforcement also realizes we're not going to arrest our way out of this problem. Especially, you know, as it concerns the addict. I think there are very few people in Lancaster County Prison, where I'm from, because they possessed heroin. I would say it's probably zero. They may have committed another crime because of their addiction, but law enforcement does recognize this as a disease, and we know we're not going to arrest our way out of it.
We have Nicole on the line from Cumberland County. Nicole, what's your question?
Hi, I have a couple comments and some questions, if that's okay. My son is 19 years old. He we found out, like, when he was about 13, he had bipolar. He started using pot around that time. We tried every program imaginable in Central PA to help him with, you know, the drug use and with his bipolar. He turned 18, and the programs out there, when you turn 18, there's very, very few, or you have to fight to find them. For instance, I called at least 25 psychiatrists to treat him because they separate them between child psychiatrists and adult psychiatrists. I could find none that would take him. So, you know, here's an 18-year-old, now 19, no treatment for his bipolar. So what's he turned to? Self-medication. So the pot turned into oxys and Xanax, and that turned into heroin just this summer. We're a good family, good household. He grew up, you know, good neighborhood. Just in the amount of education that I've received just in the last 6 months from looking for it, I'm seeing that a lot of people are not educated. We definitely need to educate the public. No one outside my family knows that my son's a heroin addict. Why? Because all the, you know, there's that opinion that they're, you know, losers, they're, you know, their families did something wrong, you know, that type of thing. And you know, I see the comments. I'm in closed Facebook groups that I found for addicts, you know, parents of addicts, things like that. That's where I'm getting a lot of the education. But we definitely need to educate people. I don't think they realize how much of a problem this heroin epidemic is. I had no clue how bad it was. I didn't know that, especially if you have an addictive personality or, you know, mental issues, that once you take that first puff, or the first time you take that injection, you're hooked. My son OD'd. He OD'd 2 weeks ago. We found him on our dining room floor. If he would have went to bed, he would have been dead because I would have thought he was sleeping. Thank goodness I found Narcan at the pharmacist. The pharmacist actually helped me with that. A lot of people don't know, because they can't afford it, that if a physician gives you a prescription for Narcan, you only have to pay a copay. If you don't have a prescription, it's $600. A lot of people won't get it because they can't afford it. They don't know that. Another thing, I see Narcan training in other states. I haven't seen it here, maybe because I'm in Central PA and not in the Philly area or what have you, but we should definitely have that here for people. They need to be educated on that. And as you said, I love your answers about the education and about, you know, why you bring these people back, because if there's a chance to get them off this and for them to live good lives, then let's take it. I'm also learning about enabling and codependency, which is very difficult. There's a fine line there. But I also wanted to say there is vaccine. Do you any of you know about the vaccine process? Apparently it's two years away, but they're trying to develop a vaccine for this. That's one of my questions. And just a couple more comments with the heroin. I don't think people realize that if we can find a way to reduce this heroin epidemic, that it'll reduce the crime. I know for a fact that my son was a drug dealer like you said, take, you know, so he was able to get the heroin because he wasn't getting it from us. He tried to steal from us at first. Now I hide my purse. We lock our accounts up, everything else. So that was his way to get the money to get the heroin. I also know that a lot of women prostitute themselves, and a lot of people end up stealing. They end up robbing places to get the money for it. And a lot of these people end up homeless because they live in households like mine where we can only do so much. And if we continue to enable them, they will continue to use. So we don't have a choice but to kick them out, so that in the hopes that they'll pick rehab over living, you know, on the streets.
Yeah.
So that's kind of my comments and my questions there. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Nicole. I think you're absolutely right. Education is the key. That's why we do these telephone town halls, to educate more people as to what's going on, what are some of the things that are out there. With respect to the Narcan training, I'll ask Barry to talk about that.
Sure. The Pennsylvania Department of Drug and Alcohol, and if you go to DDAP at pa.gov, they have an online program, and there's also another online called Get Naloxone Now, where it's an online training program for how you can administer naloxone. I think there are a number of agencies around the state and a number of efforts that are offering naloxone training, but I know you can get it online, and you even get a certificate after you've completed the program. It's only about a 20-minute program online. So I would strongly recommend that. And you may have contacted these organizations already, but let me mention them to you. There is a Cumberland Perry Single County Authority. Jack Carroll is executive director at that. The phone number for them is 717-240-6300. There's another organization called the RAISE Project. It's R-A-S-E in caps. If you Google that, that's an organization that might be a resource for you in terms of dealing with challenges with your son, given that he's got a dual diagnosis. We also, had a panelist who runs a counseling service. If you want to call the Center for Rural Pennsylvania tomorrow at 787-9555 and ask for Barry Dank, I can give you the name of that counseling service and the individual. They've worked extensively with addiction issues. That might be another resource for you.
I just also like to mention there is a standing order for naloxone or Narcan, which is issued by the Physician General of Pennsylvania to any drugstores or any pharmacy. So it's out there, and you know, if you think that you have a child or a parent or that may be addicted, especially to opioids, out of precaution, you might want to think about getting Narcan and keeping it in your home. We have Shirley on the line from Adams County. Shirley, what's your question?
Well, I have a question and a comment, and I would like to know why there are not more facilities to help treat these people that have these addictions. We have experienced this firsthand with my grandson, who I basically raised. And he started out with marijuana, and then he got pills, and he got on heroin. Good kid, worked hard, just did some of the most awful things to get his drugs. And we had him, he's overdosed three times, and each time it was worse. The last time we did not think he was going to come out of it. And we got him in a hospital. This has happened three times. Got him in. They get him clean. They keep him for 2 weeks, 4 weeks, and then they have to release him, and there's nowhere for him to go. That is what has happened to so many of the people that he's been in with, because there's no room for them. And part of, I think, of combating this is to have more places for these people to go to get counseling and help to stay off of this, because he was out the last time, he was out 2 weeks, came out clean, positive attitude, thought this time he's, because he almost did not, was not brought back, and thought that this was it, you know, he was going to make it 2 weeks, and he was right back. And you know, it's horrible. I know a lot of young people that have not made it. My granddaughter was on it. She was fortunate enough to to get into one of these rehab places, and she's doing well. But my grandson, we've not been able to get, the timing just wasn't right. We were not able to get him in. And, we need to have more treatment places for them for a longer period of time.
All right. Shirley, thank you for your question. I know that the cookie-cutter approach, meaning the same treatment for everybody, is, what we've been told is not the way to go. Treatment for addiction is an individualized process. What works for one person may not work for somebody else. 30-day time period, I use this example all the time. If you have diabetes, you can't send somebody away for 30 days and they come back and they're fixed. That's not the way your body works. And addiction is the same way. There has to be a continuum of care, and that's why this is a community problem. It is not an individual problem. It's not a family problem. It is an entire community problem, because we have to have the warm handoff, which you may hear this phrase more times tonight, but you have to have a program that the entire community is involved in, including faith-based programs are very, very important. So those are the types of things. Some people respond to what is called medication-assisted treatment, which are other drugs. There are some programs out there that are very, very effective for some people, but that's part of the problem that everybody wrestles with. Virtually everybody is different. So
I was going to just say a couple things. Pam Gay from York. A couple problems that are the hurdles, obviously, are the regulations that exist, which are important, but sometimes so cumbersome that you can't get enough treatment available for these individuals, and that's part of the problem. The funding, obviously, and we're getting better with that. I think there's been some improved funding over the last year. That's also a problem. One of the things that you can't control is that narrow window of opportunity when that addict wants to get help. And if they've been through detox and they have to wait 5 days for a rehab bed, many of them, by the time that fifth day comes around, and sometimes the fourth day, we've had individuals who die a day before getting into rehab, they will go out and use because, obviously they're going into rehab and they will die sometimes knowing that they, have to wait. That window of opportunity is gone. The desire to get help is gone. And that's why the warm handoff is so important. Get them while that desire to get help is there and when they have just about died. Very important things. The other thing I would say is there's a stigma related to medication-assisted treatment that we really have to abolish in our society. It's existed for a long time. Most of my decedents who have died that come across my desk when I'm looking at their autopsy reports have all been struggling to be abstinent, the majority of them. In other words, they just got out of rehab, prison, or some sort of period of abstinence. They use once or twice and they die. So the abstinence approach is not always working for these heroin addicts. It's very different. And so we have to get rid of the stigma of medication-assisted treatment where people think you're replacing one thing with another. You're not. You're saving lives. You're replacing death with life. And honestly, for some people, that is that's their path to sobriety, and we have to support that with the counseling, the therapy. That's all very important part of medication-assisted treatment. I don't see a whole lot of people dying from methadone and Suboxone, but I see a lot of them dying from heroin. So.
Thank you. We have Janet on the line from Dauphin County. Janet, what's your question?
Hi. I was looking at some statistics. I did hear one of the panelists speak about the fact that I guess in the county jail there was no one he knew of that was incarcerated for opiate use. But I'm concerned about the history of this and like how many people we have on parole and whether we are in any way trying to ameliorate the sentencing and the sort of damage done by the aggressive sentencing of this maybe in years past and maybe predominantly to lower income, maybe even African-American population. So I'm curious about how that's being looked at or whether there's a dialogue with the Justice Department and the probation folks to see if there's any way to shift that so that those folks aren't carrying that burden.
All right. Thank you for your question. I'm going to ask Sergeant Burkhart to take a shot at that.
Well, again, I would say that there's not probably not. I mean, I only know Lancaster County, but I would say there's probably not anybody in Lancaster County prison just for possession of heroin. I do understand what you're asking. As far as penalties for users, there has never really been stiff penalties for mere possession of a controlled substance. There are a lot of folks that are on probation because of their drug use, whether it be just for possession or because of other crimes that they've committed. I do know that part of the process of being on probation, at least in Lancaster County, is trying to find treatment for somebody whose addiction has caused their crime. Lancaster County also has alternative sentencing through drug court, where we bring, it's mostly addicts and at this point mostly heroin addicts. They go through a program, involves treatment. It also involves, you know, alternative sentencing. If they complete the program, then they're not, charge is typically expunged.
This is Barry Dank. We did hear at one of our hearings from a young woman who was a substance abuse individual for a number of years, and to support that habit, she in fact committed several felonies and served some time in jail. She has turned 180 degrees around. She is now a certified recovery specialist working in the drug addiction field, has done quite well for herself, but the reality is that she has two felony charges still on her record that in effect are haunting her when she looks for a new place to live, that type of thing. So that issue's been raised to us at the center. We're taking a look at it. I don't know that there's any quick fix, but that is something that we've heard about, and we're gonna try to take a look at that and see if there's some options available to remediate that situation for those who might have committed some type of crime, have turned their life around, gainfully employed, stayed away from any types of substance abuse issues, and what could be done.
All right, thank you. We have Robin on the line from Adams County. Robin, what's your question?
Well, it's a two-part question. My question is the treatment. I know you guys were discussing that earlier. I have a son who's 22 who is a heroin addict who has done time in York, Adams, and in state prison for crimes that he committed to get the drug heroin. The treatment, I believe, needs to be an individualized treatment because you can't clump them all together in a room for 2.5-3 hours sitting there talking about all their drug use. You're putting all of them back together. I'm trying to explain, change people, places, and things, but these programs want to throw them all back together. The other thing is they do get these, like you said, felonies against them. They would have never committed the crimes if they wouldn't have been addicted to this drug. They come out of prison and there's like you have to rush around and try to get them a job so they don't get put back in jail because their fines aren't paid. You have to get them medical assistance because they have no medical. My son was diagnosed with hepatitis C while he was in prison. Well, they didn't treat him. Cavities, they didn't take care of his cavities. His glasses, they gave him the wrong prescription. So now I'm trying to get him, you know, medical insurance so that we can get him, you know, treatment and, you know, these drug evaluations. I mean, he was evaluated so many times but never made the qualifications for a rehab. 2.5 years ago when this all started was right after his brother died, and I was sending him to California, but before I could get him to a rehab, one of his friends set him up for a drug buy, and okay, now he's got charges. I sent him to California, and I'm saying, oh, well, you have to bring him home because he has charges to answer to. They'll add more charges on him. Oh, but you can retain an attorney for $3,800, and he'll go and say he's in California on a rehab program. Well, I didn't have $3,800. I brought him back. They put him on supervised bail. Okay, he messed up on the P-test. But before he ever messed up on the P-test, I went to them and said, look, Florida will take my son. Here's a letter from Clarity Way. They accept our insurance. They will meet him at the airport. Can we just put him back into rehab down in Florida? I was told that, you know, he is 19 years of age, I couldn't control the system, and that they would decide if and when he went to a rehab. Well, when he failed his piss test, they threw him in jail. And it's like you had the beginnings right there to start trying to help an individual. But the system, everybody wants to be in control. I'm not trying to be in control. I'm trying to show them that there's better ways to help these people, whether they're 18, 19, 50, 60. It's individually. We need to be treating them individually and educating people who want to keep thinking that they're low-life scum, that, oh, well, they stole, you know, they're using this drug. I just want people to realize, and I want to thank Pam for speaking out and saying this is a disease. And just like one said, if we had a diabetic, we wouldn't be giving the diabetics all the same insulin. They would be getting insulin for what their disease required. And that's what I'm looking for my son, to try to get him back on the right track. And I thank you for listening.
Well, thank you for your comments. You hit on a lot of points, which we've heard repeatedly, and the idea of individualized treatment, I absolutely agree. That's what's required. And that's why we say that everything needs to be considered for drug treatment, whether it's inpatient, medication-assisted treatment, counseling. Everything needs to be on the table to be able to be used. The idea of individualized treatment, that's something that's fairly new. I think that we've heard that in many of the hearings, and you know, we've got ourselves in this predicament with heroin, especially, and opioids, with a whole combination of things. I mean, it's not only that the drugs came out, they were prescribed, and they were first told not to be addictive, and then it was determined that OxyContin, especially, is one of the most addictive drugs that is made. And the heroin dealers saw an opportunity to move into an area when people either couldn't get additional pills or became addicted. And if you remember, at the very beginning, I said 80% of the people that end up on heroin start by some abuse of prescription drugs. So this is a problem that we've gotten ourselves into over probably the past 15 years. And I tell people all the time that I will be happy if we can make a dent in this, in a solution, in the next 10 years. So we need to look at this differently, and I think that that's going to come slow, but we're trying to educate people, and as I said before, that's why we have these telephone town halls.
I would encourage you to seek out, too, some of the parent support groups that are out there, because there are quite a few, especially some of the nonprofits, that can help you navigate the system and help you figure out how to get your young adult the help that they really need. And I'm going to throw a plug on one that we have in York, and that's called Not One More. And it's a York, we have a York chapter, but they help families navigate the system. And I know you're in Adams, but I'm sure they'd be willing to try and help you a little bit and figure out what you can do.
We have Linda on the line from Lancaster County. Linda, what's your question?
Hi. My question is, my grandson was on heroin, and they put him on Suboxone, which I understand is a help medicine. But how long can he be on Suboxone? Can he become addicted to that? How do you ever get them off once they do get on the medical assist drug to keep them away from the heroin?
Thank you for your question. I'm going to ask the...
Okay, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a doctor. This is Pam Gay. But I will tell you that Suboxone is a really important drug for many people. Suboxone and methadone especially, Vivitrol, obviously you heard them referencing earlier about Vivitrol. But these drugs are basically Suboxone and methadone in particular, they enable a person to get their life back, to get a job back, to participate in society. Some of them get their kids back. We have professionals that are on methadone and Suboxone, you know, you'd be surprised. But the problem with Suboxone, too, though, is it can be diverted, and it can be easily sold to support a heroin habit, so or worse, actually any kind of drug habit. But, you know, it does do some wonderful things and enables people to get their lives back. Some of them are on it for years, to tell you the truth. They can be on it for months. They can be on it for years. And every plan is individual. And that's up to their counselor, their support group that they're in, or their psychiatrist that they're seeing. It's all based on their treatment in that particular, I mean, they have to have that support. If they don't have that support and they're just on Suboxone through a general practitioner, which can happen sometimes, I would say that they are not as set up for success. And so I would encourage, if they are part of Suboxone, hopefully a program and not just through their general practitioner or family doctor, and hopefully if they are just getting it through their family doctor, that they also have some sort of counseling and support set up, because that is how you succeed with Suboxone. But many people are able to eventually get off Suboxone, but it could take up to a few years before people can get off of it.
Yeah, this is Senator Yaw. I have a friend of mine who is a doctor who treats addicts on a regular basis, and he told me that he has some patients that have been on either Suboxone or methadone for as long as 10 years. And what the coroner said is absolutely true. These are drugs also, and there's no question, they are habit-forming. But they are the type of drug that somebody can take and still be a useful and productive member of society. They can have a family, they have jobs, and they go about it, but they're just dependent on it. It is one of the tools out there that are available for use for to get some people off of heroin or opioids. So it's one more thing, and you heard about the individualized treatment. It doesn't work for everybody. Some people can wean themselves off of heroin by using these drugs and then slowly getting off of those, but others, I know that the doctors have told me that it's like the crutch that they need, that they need to rely on that, and if they can become a good member of society by substituting that drug, I think it's probably worth it.
The other thing I would say is sometimes they have social things going on in their lives, and until you can fix some of those things, they're gonna need that medication-assisted treatment and so on. If you can't fix some of those things that basically are triggers in their life that cause them to want to use heroin, it's much more important that they be on medication-assisted treatment than heroin and dead.
All right, thank you. We have Robert on the line from York County. Robert, what's your question?
Yes, sir. Rather than one question, I have several points. I have been on basically pain relief, long-term pain relief, because of some of the things that's wrong with me. I had an open heart surgery in 1997, but that was 4 weeks after I had a back surgery where I had a fusion in my lower back. And when they did that, they gave me an infection. Nobody knew really what it was. This was in York Hospital. And it was the infection that went around everywhere after that. It got into my rib cage. It almost killed me. They had to basically put me on a coma, okay, to treat me, and they did a thoracotomy as well. So I had three major surgeries, one on top of the other, and the pain was unbelievable. So the long-term pain was treated with OxyContin. At the time, that was 20 years ago. At the time, that was, everybody's scapegoat. The OxyContin was long-term pain relief, and nobody thought about getting you off of it at the time. So I had that, and the doctor that I had at the time, he was reluctant to treat me with that OxyContin, and so they sent me to this pain relief specialist.
Okay,
Doctor,
so what's your question?
My question. Yes, I have a question. Now, I've been on these pain drugs. They switched me to Opana for the long-term relief, and I have been going through hell to get these pain relief drugs, even though I have prescriptions, and we have a prescription plan from my wife's work. I'm on Social Security disability because of some of the things that's wrong with me. I can't walk right because I had a bad knee replacement. Now, what my question is, has anybody thought about the problems that people like me, who through no, you know, harm of their own, have been placed on these long-term pain relievers that have basically lifetime locked them into that? Now I'm addicted to Opana, and I'm addicted to oxycodone, which they give me 5 milligrams, 6 of them a day, and I am locked into this. So why would you guys put me through hell because of what other people do when they sell their prescription, or when they basically go out and break laws? If you guys would get on, say, marijuana, medical marijuana, everybody tells me that would help me. I don't know. But I can't do it now. Obviously, it's against the law.
Thank you for your question, and we'll take the last part first. And I have heard comments about that, and I'm not sure. I think that there was a study out just recently where medical marijuana may help reduce pain.
Actually, in some cases, it does. But there have been also studies that show that, that it's not as effective as for as many things as what the initial, projections were. There is some question whether or not it can help with pain. But I would say in regards to your pain medication and your dependence on it, which I would use as instead of the term addiction, because there's a difference. There are people who have to be on long-term pain medication, and we are not, and I'm not a legislator, so I'm going to let them answer for that part. But as a coroner, I take dozens, literally dozens of bottles, me and my staff, of pain medications out of people's houses every day when they die, and we incinerate them. And so we know that it's still very much a big problem, and that people are not just addicted, but also dependent. But at the same time, we're not intent to try and take people's pain medication away. That is not our intent. We know that there are people with true chronic pain that have to be on these medications. So I don't think that's the intent of the legislature either. But are we going to crack down on it and make it a little more difficult for everybody? Unfortunately, that's part of the process if you're going to help reverse this problem. You might have to go to a doctor more frequently, be evaluated more frequently. You might not be able to get as long standing of a prescription, those kind of things. But those are all very important measures to help combat that problem. But we in no way have any intent on taking away people's pain medication for chronic pain.
Exactly. The prescription drug monitoring program that's in place now with the Department of Health is intended to monitor prescribers and dispensers of certain types of drugs. But in no way was it intended to interfere with the pain meds that somebody may need for a chronic debilitating injury or illness. Absolutely not. Clearly, there is recognition that there are individuals, unfortunately, who have lifelong challenges that require that type of pain medication. But it was a way to monitor it, and I would say also to encourage doctors to look at the prescribing of those pain meds, and might there be some other options of treatment available to individuals?
We have a couple of online questions, and one of them is here, which is a, kind of a two-part question, and I'll try and answer part of it. And it's, would the legislature support lengthy sentences for the dealers? And a little bit of a modification of that is mandatory minimums. And mandatory minimums right now, or at least the way that they were, are not permitted by court ruling or court decision in Pennsylvania. But we have heard through the hearings that we've had And I've heard this from many, many law enforcement, and especially district attorneys, that mandatory minimums are one more tool that they use in the war against the dealers. It's not the addicts. And I know that I've also been told that the majority of truly high-up dealers are not users. They're not street people, and they're in it for the money and the business, and they run it like a business. So we're thinking about the mandatory minimums again and trying to figure out some way that we could make them legal if they would pass the court standards. The other part of that question is, what steps are in place to begin to investigate the dealers who are bringing this drug into South Central Pennsylvania? Sergeant?
Steps are, we work on a weekly basis with the Drug Enforcement Agency, with the Attorney General's Office, Bureau of Narcotics Investigation, with the state police and their vice units. We're all doing what we can to stop it from coming in. Obviously, there are no opium poppy fields in Pennsylvania, so we know it's coming in, you know, from abroad. Most of our heroin is coming from Mexico, so it's got to be stopped there initially. It's brought in by any mode of transportation you can think of, boats, planes, trucks, cars, human cavities, everything. We've got to be able to stop it from its source, and for this area, it is Mexican heroin. So we've got to work together as law enforcement at all levels and communicate with one another to stop it that way. It goes from the cartels to the big dealers here, and then just moves down to the, you know, the street level dealer.
Okay, thank you. We have Tracy on the line from York County. Tracy, what's your question?
Yeah, hi, folks. Thank you so much for your service that you're giving to the community. I really do appreciate this forum. It sounds as if there's some resources available to the community, but the information's not making it to those of us in the community. Unfortunately, I'm hearing that your parents are in desperate need of professional support, and unfortunately, Pennsylvania does not have a robust psychiatric environment. Many people do have to go to Annapolis to receive treatment. I don't know if there's an incentive program available to draw in the psychiatric profession. However, my question is, as for educating the community, for me, it starts with the kids. I'm a teacher. There is a wonderful introductory program within the elementary sector. However, it really does become a joke within the middle school. What is being done in the middle school and high schools to drive this danger home? For instance, once a year they do that drunk driving skit where they use students as realistic actors and they have an emergency airlift helicopter come in. Is there some kind of scared straight program for heroin drug addiction? Do these kids have, are there programs where they have opportunities to work with those who have been through what maybe they could be going through? They can hear from an actual kid. The reason I'm asking that is because if we can address this on the academic level, the schools can then send home information at the beginning of the school year along with this various other paperwork such as the school code of conduct. Maybe schools can even add to their website a set of resources for those of us seeking help. That's my question.
Great ideas. I'll tell you a little bit of what, this is Pam talking from the coroner's office. I'll tell you what's going on in York County since you're from York, Tracy. You know, we have some wonderful programs that we're using in York County right now. One of them is Burns Education Health Center partnered with us and actually partnered with our Heron Task Force and developed a curriculum and an interactive type program that goes into the middle school and high school levels. And this program is called Heron the Wake-Up Call, and it basically focuses on heroin, but it brings in a little bit about prescription drug abuse. The coroner's office themselves goes out to dozens of schools in the last 2.5 years. We've actually presented publicly or privately about 115 times in the Heron Task Force and the coroner's office since July of 2014. So we're free, but we can certainly provide that education. Also, another really kind of neat thing that has evolved from all this, Back when individuals were being saved with Narcan initially, I had media approach me and they wanted to know, hey, we'd really like to talk to somebody who's been saved by Narcan. And I was like, hold off, wait about 2 years, because many of them are not in the mode to thank anybody who just saved their life. They're still deep in the throes of their addiction. And sure enough, here 2 years later, after Narcan being administered in York County now for almost 2 years by law enforcement, we are starting to have some individuals who have been saved by Narcan who are actually going around with that entity that I talked about earlier, not one more, young people who are going into the schools. And it's just amazing to see how the kids listen to young people telling how they've been saved and what their life was like beforehand and what they're doing now. And they don't glorify it. They focus on the poor decisions that they made, and but what they're showing is that there's hope and that people actually do recover and can get into sobriety. And we're seeing more and more schools that are opening up their doors to allowing this type of format. And I think that's probably the most effective because the students can see somebody who's only a couple years different than they are in age, who's actually almost destroyed their life and actually did, you know, sometimes hamper their relationship with family and friends, but now is getting their life back on track. So those are some of the things that are just going on in York alone. I would, you know, any community probably has some sort of education going on. The schools are getting much more proactive with this and very supportive of it.
This is Barry Dang. At some of the hearings we heard, some schools still have very active student assistance programs that are extremely resourceful for that peer interaction. You mentioned a couple programs. The DARE program, extremely popular, but it's not evidence-based. The research on that really did not show that it had the intended results. Same with Scared Straight. Those programs for youth particularly must be age-appropriate. Young people, they've not developed mentally enough to really understand some of the risk. In fact, young people could be risk takers. It's not going to happen to me type of thing. So sometimes that Scared Straight program just doesn't affect them as it would an adult in terms of outcomes of bad choices. The other thing is we heard from Penn State. They have a center called the EPIS. It's EPIS Center out of Penn State. Dr. Stephanie Bradley is the managing director of that, and they focus exclusively on evidence-based programs and outcomes in terms of education and prevention. I would think they would be a good resource to get in touch with to hear about types of evidence-based programs that's age-appropriate for our young people.
All right, thank you. We have Erica on the line from Lancaster. Erica?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. My concern is, are doctors and the medical community being closely monitored regarding opioid prescriptions? And the reason I'm asking, I had a son, and he had many surgeries. He was prescribed from fentanyl on down. He got addicted. He got dependent. The doctor retired, ultimately. My son could not find another doctor that could prescribe enough to take care of his problem. So he turned to basically street drugs. What ended up killing him was a prescription that was legally prescribed to a friend of his. The friend sold him the prescription. So here's a case of two doctors which maybe should have been a little bit more careful what they were prescribing. So is the medical community being monitored?
Thank you for your question. As far as the drug registry program in the state, that became online, I think, in August of 2016. So that's up and running now. It's about 6 months old. From what we hear, it's a help. But unfortunately, I think also we don't have any numbers in yet. But what some law enforcement people have told me is that there will probably be a spike in heroin use as more and more people are unable to doctor shop. Barry, you have any thoughts or comments about that?
As I mentioned to a prior caller, the prescription drug monitoring program really is to hone in on the prescribing and the dispensing of those types of drugs. And just the other day, there was legislation introduced in the House that would require opioids to be only prescribed through electronic means and not paper scripts, because that paper document could be stolen, sold on the street, that kind of thing. So I know from a legislative standpoint, there are some efforts in place. Also, the continuing medical education requirements that are now in place for docs dealing with opioid prescriptions to get them to better understand the issuance of those and some of the side effects. And I think Coroner Gay has some comments.
Yeah, there are actually area hospitals now that are really getting much more aggressive with educating their staff, their medical providers, about reducing their opioid prescribing and changing their opioid prescribing practices. And actually, WellSpan and OSS have been very instrumental in reducing in just the last year. And so we've made some great progress in York. I think probably Lancaster has similar initiatives. I know that that is going on throughout the state, and I think that is a key too. You got to get your area hospitals to definitely get their providers to agree to monitor and also to decrease their prescribing of opioids.
All right, thank you. We have Michael on the line from Lancaster. Michael, what's your question?
Hi, yes, just a quick question. I was interested in, is there any, I know these individualized programs for users, addicts, is there any data about how long those programs are effective? I mean, which ones are more effective? Are they longer? I've heard that, 2 months, 3 months doesn't do much, but it takes at least a year.
Thank you for your question. I think it the answer to it is it depends on the person. We've talked several questions tonight about individualized treatment. And some people actually respond to a 30-day program. Others, it takes 60, 90 days. We've heard of people that have been in programs for more than a year, actually inpatient. Some of the programs are the medication-assisted treatments, like a Vivitrol program. So it really does depend on the person. Now, if you were asking I thought you asked a question about detoxing, how long it takes to detox, and I've said that one of the backhand benefits to having somebody in prison is at least while they're in prison, they detox. And I don't know what the time period is, two weeks, three weeks, something like that?
Heroin has a short half-life, so it doesn't take long for it to leave the system, but I'm not a doctor, so I would say it's a couple days. Usually when I hear about addicts who've been in detox, it's been a couple days.
And I know a lot of the programs that are out there, like, for example, Vivitrol, in order to get into that program, you have to have detox. You can't have it in your system. But it varies. It's across the board as to the timing and the individuals involved, and that's what we have not learned to deal with yet, I think, is, in all the treatment programs, we've got to look at this as like, this is a different situation. It's really a different ballgame, and everybody is just a little bit different.
This is Detective Burkhart. I will say that in speaking with families of addicts and a lot of addicts that have died from overdoses of heroin, one of the biggest complaints from them is these short-term programs. To a family, they've all stressed that you need to get these addicts into long-term programs. The short-terms just do not work.
And I will also say that part of the problem is, too, some of the addicts will sign themselves out before their treatment is complete, and that's just a constant problem, and there's nothing you can do about that.
We have a online question, and or I guess it may be a comment. I'll just throw it out to everybody, and it's this. It is really scary that the Mexican drug cartel is right here in York County. What is the enforcement doing to the Mexican heroin to get it off the streets of York?
I don't know if that's in response to what I was talking about is a source.
It may have been.
I'm not saying the cartel has a presence here. I'm saying that the cartels were the initial point that the heroin was coming from, and however it was brought into the United States from there and worked its way to Pennsylvania and any other state. I'm not saying there's not a cartel presence, but there's not, the cartel is not here. There may be individuals from cartels here. I know in the past in Lancaster County, now this was a cocaine case, but we arrested cartel members in Lancaster County. It was two or three individuals at that time, not the entire cartel.
And I will say that in York, I can't answer for our drug task force and the DA's office at this point, but I can tell you that we treat every heroin-related death, every drug death pretty much that's illicit or that we think might even be illegally obtained prescription drugs, but especially the heroin, we treat them as a crime from the beginning. Law enforcement collects the phones. Law enforcement does an aggressive investigation. They couple with the DA's office right away. The coroner's office sends emails right away to the DA's office and lets them know that this is a suspected heroin-related death. The DA works along with that local law enforcement to give them the support that they need, and when the autopsy report comes back showing the content of that drug or confirming it, they get aggressive, if not beforehand. Sometimes they've actually arrested the dealer beforehand. Within 48 hours, we've had some arrests. So we are definitely getting aggressive with these and going after that charge, drug delivery resulting in death.
We have Mark on the line from Cumberland County. Mark, what's your question?
Yes, a couple things. Why isn't there more methadone programs? And another thing is people that I've been hearing talk about prescription drugs, the doctors they should be doing drug tests on these people that they're giving prescriptions to make sure the drugs are in their system that they're prescribed and not any other drugs. If you have other drugs, they should be shut off. I mean, and feel sorry for the people that lost their family members, but treatment only works if you stay people, places, and things. You got to stay away from the people, the places, and the things that made you do them to start with. And family members, it's how to say, but a lot of it is the codependency. You can't try to take care of the ones you love and feed them, give them money, and let them steal from you. My main thing is how come there isn't more methadone programs, because that's the only, I mean, it's not a today problem. This has been going on for 40 years. I know people that have been in methadone programs, and they can work. They can carry on with their life.
All right. Thank you, Mark. Your observations are very good. From my experience, some methadone treatments programs are not looked on very favorably by neighborhoods, and it's the stigma of drug addiction, which we've heard about tonight. And if you have some kind of a drug treatment facility, no matter what it is, they're not the most welcome. I'd invite anybody else to.
I would say that the methadone treatment programs have improved. There are a lot more spots in the methadone treatment programs in our country, or in the country in general, but in our state. Thanks to the funding that has been provided over the last year or so. So it's not perfect, but the spots have improved. There's strict criteria to be in a methadone program. They have to be monitored very carefully. It's not exactly the easiest thing. They have to actually go physically and take that drug in front of a person. Sometimes they can go on it at home, but they have to meet certain criteria before they can do that. But I think we made some tremendous strides there. In regards to the doctor's testing when people are on prescription drugs, I will say that you almost can't be a physician anymore without doing that. That is becoming pretty much the norm, the standard. Hospitals are getting more aggressive with that. I'm not saying that there aren't some family care practitioners out there, maybe older practitioners who may not be testing, but more and more of the newer providers are doing that, and I think we're going to see a constant goal to improve that, and you're going to see more and more of that. So I think we've made some tremendous strides in that area.
We have Debbie on the line from Adams County. Debbie, what's your question?
I lost my son in August to an overdose of oxycodone, and Pam Gay, you were the coroner and you are a wonderful person. If you feel that a doctor is or has overprescribed oxycodone, how do you go about having that doctor, maybe their records checked out, not to file a lawsuit or anything like that, but I think this forum has been great. I do believe that doctors need to be educated on pain management. How do you go about reporting a doctor if you see how they are prescribing, over-prescribing medications?
All right. Debbie, thank you for your question. I'm going to ask both Pam and Sergeant Burkhart to take a shot at your question.
Well, Debbie, I would say, first of all, you can go to the American Medical Society, the chapter for your particular area, York, if it's York. You can also go to the Pennsylvania Department of Health and report that person. I think that's probably a more direct way of doing it and probably get faster results. And obviously, if your concern is that they could be overprescribing to other individuals, I certainly understand that. You have every right to do that. So I don't have those numbers in front of me, but you can Google, and you know, Pennsylvania Department of Health would be able to point you in the right direction, I'm pretty sure. So, and maybe you have a better
yes,
idea.
And I would say, I mean, I was going to suggest the Department of Health also, but if you feel it's a criminal act, or which we call diversion, you know, putting those pills out there when you know they're not going to be used for a patient, you can call your local police. You can call the Attorney General's Office, Bureau of Narcotics Investigation. You can call your local drug task force and report that kind of activity if you suspect a doctor of doing that.
All right. Thank you. We have Mary on the line from York County. Mary?
Good evening, and thank you for this opportunity. I see a lot of parents with adult children living at home that are depleting their income trying to help these kids. Well, no, not kids. They're adults now. But how do addicts without a means of income or insurance get the maintenance drugs such as Suboxone in order to stay off of the heroin?
Hi, this is Barry. There are what it's called Seal County authorities serving all 67 counties in Pennsylvania. And if I understood correctly, you're in York County, and there is an SCA that serves Adams and York County.
It's York County Drug Alcohol.
And Audrey Gladfelter is the director, and the phone number there is 717-771-9222. The single county authorities are a means of identifying programs and resources for individuals to get into treatment, and in fact, they have funds that can cover programs for treatment. The other thing is that there's the centers of excellence that have been opened up throughout the state, funded by the Department of Human Services. They are predominantly Medicaid funded, so income eligible individuals can get assistance of medication-assisted treatment and counseling through those centers of excellence. But I would strongly recommend contacting the single county authority at that number I just gave you, and they are a way to get you into the system and find out what's available and how someone might be eligible to get some services and treatment that is covered with some type of government funds.
And we have two centers of excellence in York. We have a Family First Health and Pennsylvania Counseling Services. So you can check with any of those entities and they'll be able to help you.
All right, thank you. We have Jim on the line from Lancaster. Jim, what's your question?
Thank you. It's actually a comment, and I appreciate the time and effort that's put into this. I do want to note that it is encouraging to hear all the conversation about Medicaid-assisted treatment. And the one thing that's been missed in all that the conversation about this is that Medicaid-assisted treatment is actually evidence-based. And it's evidence-based around the whole model of treatment. And as we think about treatment, treatment is a disease model. So I think it is, it's still, it is clearly pointed out through the conversation that it is still, there's a lot of stigma around it. But the medication-assisted treatment, whether it is the Suboxone or Methadone that helps to replace the craving or the Vivitrol that actually blocks the craving, really has some really credible science behind it. But the medication in and of itself is not the only thing that works. And this goes back to the whole point of this conversation that you're having is that it is a community approach. A couple of the people talked about changing persons, places, and things, and that is part of that that needs to go along with the medications to the treatment. So I just want to thank you for talking about the MAT because it is where the cutting edge of science and where we're seeing that real change is taking place with people that are caught up in this insidious addiction.
Thank you for your question or your comments. I agree, and I've actually talked to the manufacturers of Vivitrol, and they do not say that you know, medication is not the, that's not the solution to the problem. The only thing is it's one of the tools, and especially Vivitrol, the purpose of it is they prescribe a or suggest a six-month treatment program is hopefully during that 6 months the person will needs to change their behavior. They need to change their friends. They need to, because if at the end of the time they go right back into the same friends, the same living habits, they're going to revert right back. It's like holding a rubber band, and when you let go of it, it's going to go right back to its regular shape unless there is something else. That's why the community program, the warm handoff, and all those things are so important. And, you know, eventually we will all realize that it's financially in our own best interest to deal with this problem because it affects healthcare, it affects law enforcement, it affects what happens in our prisons. So it is a it is a big community issue, and it's a big community problem. We have Diane on the phone from York County. Diane, what's your question?
Hi. I have a question. I think I may know the answer to it, but I want the expert's opinion. Why do dealers mix fentanyl in with the heroin that causes these deaths? 5 weeks ago today, I lost my 27-year-old son to an overdose. And he was visiting his girlfriend in Philadelphia. And he overdosed on the 30th. She didn't realize what was happening. And she called an ambulance. They got him to the hospital. His heart stopped 5 times on the way there. They brought him back. He was on life support until the following Tuesday. That was a Friday. Till the following Tuesday, we had to, he was just without oxygen for so long. So we suspect, it wasn't confirmed or checked for, but we suspect through the text that we read on his phone where he got it at Kensington Avenue in Philly, and we suspect that it was fentanyl laced, synthetic fentanyl laced. Why do the dealers put fentanyl in when it kills people? And I think I know the answer, but I want to hear what you guys say.
I believe there's actually multiple answers to that. First of all, it's a cheap cutting agent. It's another drug, another opioid that will make their substance, that dealer's substance, wanted more than other dealers. So basically what they want to do is make their stuff more potent, advertise it as a better high. That's one reason. And then the third reason is, another reason is that I don't think they know what they're putting in. And a lot of this stuff moves down, like if you're saying he bought it on Kensington Avenue, a lot of dealers from Lancaster County will drive down and they'll buy bulk amounts of heroin in that area. They have no idea. Usually it's prepackaged. It's already stamped with a brand name if they do that. They bring it back. They have no idea what's in that. And they start selling it, say, in Lancaster City, and the next thing you know, people are dying from it.
Diane, it's Pam Gay. I want to first of all tell you how sorry I am for the loss of your son. I can't imagine a mother losing her child, but I want you to realize that there are other people. You're not alone, and I think you know that. But I would encourage you to since you're from York, that you check in with a Not One More, that York chapter, because they can really give you a lot of support right now that you probably could benefit from. But, yeah, I have to agree with the detective. The main reason that we see the fentanyl, we think, being mixed in is that they're trying to attract a group of people to that drug because of the better high, supposedly. We all know that they're not really using to get high anymore. They're using just to keep from being dope sick, the withdrawal. And so it's a vicious cycle.
Yeah, and one of the things that we heard in many of the hearings that we had through the Center for Rural Pennsylvania, and the best description that I've heard about this, is that, like, it's equated to, if you like hot peppers, you are always looking for a hotter pepper. And unfortunately, that's what happens. And there's also, in addition to fentanyl, there's carfentanil out there, which is used to sedate elephants. And, you know, unfortunately, people, you know, some people take it by mistake, that they don't know what they're taking. Others probably do it deliberately without knowing what the effect's going to be. So there's multiple reasons out there why it's done. Well, it looks like our time is up tonight. This has been a terrific discussion. I'd like to thank our special guest this evening, York County Coroner Pam Gay, Detective Sergeant John Burkhart of the Lancaster County Drug Task Force, and Barry Dank, the Director of the Center for Rural Pennsylvania. Also, I want to thank our sponsors this evening, Senator Rich Alloway, Senator Ryan Aumet, Senator John DeSanto, Senator Mike Fulmer, Senator Scott Martin, Senator Mike Regan, Senator Scott Wagner. Thank you to everyone who listened in this evening and to those who shared opinions and asked questions. If you have any remaining questions or concerns regarding the issue of heroin and opioid addiction, I encourage you to remain on the line, to leave a message, and someone will follow up with you, or visit our website at www.acommonwealthcrisis.com. This is a great tool to assist Pennsylvanians to talk and learn about the ever-growing heroin and opioid crisis, which is taking lives of our citizens every day. Thank you again for your participation, and have a great evening.